morning. We start our discussion this morning with business combination from the common control. Julia.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, everyone. So in April, we plan to present to the board a summary of findings in our research and outreach activities that we have performed after the board made a decision on the scope of the project. And just to remind you that the decision on the scope that the board has made was consistent with the advice provided by the ASAP. So at this meeting, we would like to discuss our findings with you and also to provide you an update on our preliminary view. And we would be interested in your feedback on our preliminary view, and we will reflect it in our future papers for the board. I will start with an overview of what we've done and what we have learned, and then move on to our preliminary view. So overall, after the scope decision was made, we performed over 30 meetings with various interested parties from various jurisdictions, including users, standard setters, preparers, accounting firms, with particular focus on users of financial statements. In our outreach, we sought to understand both how business combinations under common control tend to be accounted for in practice today, and also how they should be accounted for. And more specifically, in our initial outreach, we focused on which method or methods should be used to account for business combinations under common control. And in our most recent outreach, we focused on how the predecessor method is applied or should be applied. And in our outreach, we used various illustrative scenarios. So when we discussed the method, we used two illustrative scenarios involving NCI and also involving an IPO, and we discussed those scenarios with you. And in our recent outreach, we used an illustrative numerical example to discuss the application of the predecessor method. We also discussed this example with you. So in terms of what we've learned, I think it's fair to say that it sounds like in practice, business combinations under common control tend to be accounted for under the predecessor method. This is the method that is most commonly applied. However, in some jurisdictions, the acquisition method is also applied to some business combinations under common control. In terms of which method should be applied, I think we've heard a significant amount of support for the application of the predecessor method, either for all business combinations under common control, or at least using it as a default method of accounting for business combinations under common control, and then using the acquisition method if particular conditions are met. I think probably slightly different feedback on the method we received from users, and user feedback was a little bit more mixed than feedback from other interested parties. So generally, we heard more support from users for the application of the acquisition method, and especially so in a scenario where NCI is involved. In terms of how predecessor method is applied or should be applied, I think it's fair to say that there is diversity in practice in application today. So in some cases, carrying amounts of combining entities are used and comparative information is not restated. In other cases, carrying amount at the common control are used and comparative information is restated. And I think the feedback that we've heard in terms of how it should be applied, we also heard some mixed feedback. So some people think, you know, we need to reflect the perspective of combining entities, whereas others think we should reflect the perspective of the common control. One consistent piece of feedback, though, that we received on the application of the predecessor method is that the board should not mandate where in equity any difference between consideration and transferred net assets should be recognized. Finally, a couple of words on the agenda consultation, because this is quite important in terms of whether we continue with the project. About half of the respondents to agenda consultation, and this is consistent for comment letters and user survey, about half of the respondents commented on business combinations under common control, and almost all of them thought that the project was of medium or high importance, and only a few respondents thought that it was of low importance. So this is where we stand in terms of what we've learned on the project in the last few months. So in terms of our preliminary view, we think that the board could discuss two approaches. One approach is where all business combinations under common control will be accounted for under the predecessor method. And the main attraction of this approach is its simplicity and also consistency in accounting for all business combinations under common control. Its disadvantage is that arguably business combinations that under common control that demonstrate characteristics of arm's length transactions would arguably not be accounted in the best possible way. Another approach that the board could explore is an approach where business combinations under common control would normally be accounted for under the predecessor method, but then if specified conditions are met, the acquisition method would be applied. And the main challenge with this approach would be trying to draw the line when the acquisition method is applied and when the predecessor method is applied, and it would introduce a lot of judgment in the application. However, we think that both approaches have merit and they should be considered. In terms of how predecessor method is applied, we think that there is an interaction between various aspects of the predecessor method. So we think that if the accounting reflects the perspective of the combining entities, then carrying amounts of the combining entities should be used and comparative information should not be restated. If we're trying to reflect the perspective at the common control, then we should be using the carrying amounts at the level of common control and restating comparative information. And our preliminary view is that we're trying to reflect the perspective of combining entities, and therefore we do not restate, and we take the carrying amounts at that level. So this is a sort of quick overview of where we are, and we would be most interested in your thoughts.
Just for clarification,
yes,
you said a drawback of predecessor method only could be had something to do with arm's length transaction.
Yes, so I think the main challenge with those transactions is that they can be directed by the controlling party as opposed to being freely negotiated between combining entities. And because they can be directed of controlling by controlling party, they could be performed at other than fair value, and they do not necessarily reflect best interests of the combining entities. And so that's trying to figure out.
But the reason why it could be seen as a disadvantage is that if all other characteristics of the transaction are what you would expect to see in an arm's length transaction between third parties, then the argument is we wouldn't be accounting for that business combination in a consistent way with the third parties.
Sorry, thank you. Just a question on the predecessor method is what happens if one of the entities hasn't been applying IFRS?
I think this is a very common question that often arises. So we think that normally you would apply an approach similar to application of IFRS 1. And it's also, you will probably have a similar situation where the transferred entity has been applying IFRS, but its accounting policies are different from the one to which it's transferred. So you will need to sort of adjust accounting policies. So it's still sort of, it's carrying amounts but adjusted for difference in accounting policies. And so using a national gap before a combination, it's the same scenario taken to its extreme, basically.
So you would need to apply some form of IFRS 1
Thank you. To us, it was unclear which reporting entity we were talking about. Is it about the ultimately controlling party or the actual two combining entities? And depending on that, we would probably have a different answer. And I just want to talk.
We're talking about financial statements of the combining entities, not about financial statements of the controlling party. There could be an additional question about which of the combining entities is the surviving entity or the receiving entity, but we're talking about that level, not the higher level.
Okay.
Nobu, in most cases, if you talk about the ultimate controlling of parent entity, they will control the two entities that will combine together.
Yes.
So in consolidation, you can expect that the effect of combining two entities which are controlled by the parent at the consolidation level will not have any impact because all...
That would be our view.
Okay.
And if we look at the combining entities, we might think of a normal acquisition. So that would be our debate. We haven't really came to a conclusion, but depending on which reporting entity we were talking about, we might have reached a different answer.
Yeah.
That was it.
Alberto?
Well, our view is that not all the business combination under common control should be accounted for under the predecessor method, but there are instances where the acquisition method would be more relevant for the interested parties, generally speaking, and the users, especially if there is a substantial amount of non-controlling interest. In this case, in some jurisdiction at least, there are also protection for the non-controlling interest in the sense that fair value must be real fair value, and independent expert is appointed to verify this. So that really are more arm's length than normal transaction under common control. So this is our view. Of course, we are talking of restructuring within the group, that predecessor method is applied. And in Italy, I believe in many other jurisdictions, there have already been business combination under common control. So and we have seen, at least in Italy, that this is works relatively well. Of course, drawing the line between when using one or the other is not so easy. I don't think we will come up with the bright lines, but with some indications, and then leave to the judgment of the preparers and their stakeholders.
Andreas?
Thanks, Hans. Our position is quite similar to Alberto's. There is local guidance by the German Institute that would foresee a rebuttable presumption, so to say. So you use the predecessor method unless there's clear evidence that something else is going on. The question, though, is what is going on? And the criterion they use, and I think I've said that about half a year ago, is that they use the criterion of economic substance, as you say in your papers as well. I think this is a flawed criterion, because nobody is just shifting around boxes for fun. There, in almost all cases, is an economic reason why you do it. It may not be evident to the outside world, but certainly there is some sort of a reason, could be tax or whatever. So I think what you ought to focus on is who is the ultimate recipient of the information. Because if the information is directed towards current shareholders, I think there's a strong case to be made that predecessor accounting is the right answer. If you say the recipient is anybody who is interested as a third party in the financial accounts of that combined entity, I think it makes a stronger case for successor or acquisition method accounting.
Under predecessor accounting, so those transactions, either all or the subset that would receive predecessor accounting, the basis that's applied, that is, from the perspective of the controlling party or the combining entities, seems to me somewhat related to the issue of push-down accounting. That is, if you've already pushed down the parent's basis, and I know I've heard conflicting views of whether or not, and certainly in practice, seen conflicting application of push-down accounting. I recall that SEC sending a letter to the ISB actually asking to clarify push-down accounting, and I don't recall that it was clarified, and that was sent because there was differing views applied in practice. So I think that question is hard to answer without at least first answering very clearly whether or not a parent can push down their basis to or a controlling party can push down their basis. So I think those are at least somewhat interrelated questions.
But we don't really have push down accounting under IFRS. So.
Yeah, I've seen it applied in practice, which is why the which is why the SEC sent a letter to the IASB asking you to clarify that.
Alexander?
Actually, there was no consensus in my jurisdiction of actually not even within the country, so there are divergences about that. But one thing that was a question in everybody's mind is, if you take your illustration 1B here, for example, they got three companies, P1, A, and B, and let's assume, as it is the case in some places, that those three companies are listed companies with different minority shareholders. So you take 30% public in company A. Here, imagine there is a minority shareholder. And imagine that company A is buying company B, acquiring company B, and paying cash. Mm. So it's paying more than the book value of equity of company B. And if you apply the predecessor accounting, it's what ends up happening is that it will pay 100 and receives 75. So how do you account for the 25 difference? Because the minority shareholder of company A is going to say, well, you bought that company, how my book value factor is going to decrease? So it's just a transaction. So let's say, because if you don't have goodwill, how do I account for it? So you're going to deduct it from the book value effect, like the British accountants are used to say, but there is a transaction, I'm a minority shareholder, how my book value effect is going to be reduced after a transaction in the market. So what most people are saying about predecessor accounting, especially when dealing with listed companies with different minority shareholders, actually cannot be applied because it violates basic logic. So do you understand my point?
I do understand, yes. So essentially you can have a situation where you have NCI where you sort of transfer value in or out of NCI.
Yeah.
And that raises a question whether...
Say an example here. Company A acquires company B, but paying cash.
Yeah.
Let's assume that. So how do you account for the difference? If it's goodwill, so it is acquisition accounting, that's simple. So you have goodwill. But if you do not have goodwill, how do you account for that? So then you're going to reduce book value of equity.
Yes.
Mm. But yeah. To say, well, there is we just acquired another company, then we have a reduction of book value of equity, which is, for minority, it's a
company which was valued more than the book value. So
yes.
It's counterintuitive.
It's complicated for a non-accountant. It cannot be explained to a non-accountant. I don't know if you can explain to an accountant, but for a non-accountant, it's completely illogical. You understand the point?
I understand, yes.
Carla?
So our view is, although we see that in many cases, predecessor method makes sense, but I think echoing Andreas's point, we think that there should be sort of more clear principles developed as to, for example, if the combination is just reflecting an extract of the existing group, then you think that predecessor method makes sense. But if, for example, the combination takes place because there is a further objective, and so it's more like an acquisition, then you think that acquisition method should apply. But at the same time, I think there's a bigger question around what is a BCUCC. Mm. So to Noble's point earlier, from which level are you, what is... So yes, you're looking at the combined entities level, but when you say it's a BCUCC, it's driven from the ultimate parent's point of view. So if it's a common control or business combination under common control, then I think there needs to be sort of a clarification around what transactions fall under BCUCC, because there is also a view out there that if you do a combination or a restructuring in preparation for an IPO, eventually, when the IPO takes place, there's no acquirer. So it's a demerger, where the existing shareholders get it, or it's floated. So that's not actually an acquisition. So is that actually a BCUCC, although the restructuring might. So maybe looking at the whole thing and sort of clarifying what a BCUCC is, and then sort of driving the principles around, so these types of combinations would be, more sort of predecessor accounting, and then these ones, which are more in substance, like an acquisition, would be acquisition accounting. And maybe for something like an IPO, it doesn't make sense that you revalue the one entity but not the other, because they want both the values, so maybe it's just the fair value of which, of the combined group,
yeah.
Combined entities. So I think there needs to be more thinking around the different scenarios. And then coming down to for example, the NCI situation, I get that, when there are NCIs, when there is NCI involved, fair value because, you know, you want to make sure that the transaction is at arm's length and all that, and so maybe the consideration is that fair value. But I'm not sure that the PPA, exercise, it should be driven by, you know, there is an NCI, not an NCI, because even in the current literature, you say in paragraph B4 that the NCI shouldn't be something that drives what a BCUCC is. So, you know, the structure that you've kind of given, which is 30%, 70% and 100, and then the 100 goes below the 70, I mean, is that something, I'm not sure, does when, you know, because that results in a dilution, you know, so is that a common transaction? You know, so I guess kind of looking at, you know, how often these kind of transactions happen when there is a dilution, and sort of thinking of, and the NCI perspective, you know, whether that's relevant or not in consideration of BCC as a whole, I think it's a useful exercise. And sorry, just and I think to your points around, you know, so for predecessor method itself, whether you should do use ultimate parent's value or, you know, existing, the combining entity or the acquiree's values, or, and whether it should be date of acquisition, whether it should be restated, and whether the difference should go to equity. I think once you've decided predecessor method, then I think you should develop the principles based on predecessor method. So if it's a BCUCC, then keep it pure in that, okay, you are going for restatements rather than date of acquisition. But if you decide that those transactions are like more like acquisition, then it should be driven by the acquisition accounting principles. And then in terms of the carrying value, ultimate value, I think general preference would be, because you're saying it's driven by the ultimate parent, then you use the parent's values, unless they are not IFRS numbers, and then you give the option that they can use the carrying values of the entities combining. And yes, we agree that the equity, just, I don't think you should dabble with that and just let the jurisdictions deal with where the difference should go.
Maybe if I could comment on a couple. I think you've touched upon many, many different questions. So I wanted to come back on the scope just to clarify that. So first of all, scope is something which is on our radar already, because we focus so far on transactions that would meet the description of business combination under common control. And I actually think that it's quite clear what that population is, because we have sort of a scope exclusion in IFRS. So it is a business, it's a transaction that meets the definition of business combination, but it is a transaction that takes place under common control. However, obviously there is another subset of transactions that are group restructurings, which is an undefined set of transactions, and this is something we need to look at, obviously, and clarify. And then coming back to your point about, well, if it does not sort of reflect characteristics of an acquisition, it means that you need to apply the controlling party perspective. And again, the way we thought about it is that if you have a common controlling party, obviously there is a possibility that this transaction is not freely negotiated, but it reflects the perspective of that controlling party. However, we are talking about, back to Novo's comment, we are talking about accounting at the level of combining entities. So basically, the fact that it's under common control defines, you know, whether we can or cannot apply the acquisition method. But once we decided, okay, it is a predecessor method, it doesn't mean, I don't think, that the method itself should reflect the perspective of the controlling party. And just to give you an example, if we were to say, okay, because it reflects controlling party perspective, let's take amounts at the level of the controlling party. But if you were to do it for one of the combining entities, why would you not do it for the other combining entity, which goes back to the question of push-down accounting? So we think that the presence of controlling party can be relevant to determining which method you apply, but then still, once you apply the method, you do it at the level of the combining entities. These were just my observations and just positive comments.
One E.
regarding the question of which method is more appropriate, most ASS members pointed out the importance of establishing a conceptual basis to support the method, the importance of performing more research on the information needs of users was also highlighted by some members. At a specific level, there are different views. Some members argued that the acquisition method would be more appropriate when NCIs exist or when there is a significant presence of NCIs. However, one member noted that it was important to understand conceptually why the mere presence of NCIs in a BCUCC may lead to a different accounting method. And one member noting the difficulty to establish principles that would support one method over another argued that both methods should be available and an entity should establish an accounting policy to choose the most appropriate method. And another member noted that the predecessor method is a recommended practice based on their local regulation. And the, regarding the issue of the application of the predecessor methods, there is no general consensus with respect to which carrying amount should be used in the application of the predecessor methods. One member noted that carrying amounts per the ultimate controlling party should be used, but that carrying amount per the transferred entity could be used when IFRS comply information from the perspective of the ultimate controlling party is unavailable. And another member pointed out there was an inconsistency conceptually between the ISP steps preliminary view of the using the carrying amounts of the transferred entity and the conceptual basis of the predecessor method. One member noted that practical merit in the ISP step preliminary views to support using the carrying amount reported by the transferred entity, but reminded that a robust conceptual basis should be established. And regarding, I mean, reading the comments from AOS members, I've got a sense that the members are generally pointing out the importance of establishing a conceptual basis for this project. So I would just like to propose an idea of how we can examine the conceptual basis. I think there should be two separate assessments, and one assessment against the relevance and the other assessment against the faithfulness. The assessment against relevance deals with the question of good or bad. In other words, the assessment focuses on which method is perceived better by users. And an area to look at is whether NCIs have different information needs and therefore one method should be preferred over another. And based on this assessment, I think the ISP should make a kind of sub-decision on which method is better or whether there is no difference between the method in terms of relevance. And after that, assessment against faithfulness should deal with the question of a right or wrong. In other words, it focuses on which method better reflects the economic substance. I believe one method would better reflect economic substance in one circumstance and another method would better reflect economic substance in another circumstance. The board, however, I think would need to make another sub-decision on which method is right, or different methods can be permitted depending on circumstances. And if the two sub-decisions support the same one method, then it would be very easy to make a final decision, but I guess it wouldn't be likely. Therefore, I think we need to make an assessment against enhancing qualitative characteristics in the conceptual framework. We should try to explore which method is more useful by assessing against verifiability, understandability, comparability, and timeliness. Then the ISP should make a final decision. So I guess this is a very broad framework to assess or establish a conceptual basis about which method is better.
Thank you, Hans. Generally, we agree with the approach to apply the predecessor method to all business combination and common control and group restructurings. However, for those business combination and common control and group restructurings for IPOs, as mentioned, as Carla mentioned, that because in China, those transactions for IPOs, the fair value approach or so-called evaluation approach are allowed or actually are required by Chinese laws. So in this case, we hope that for those business combination and common control for IPOs, a fair value approach or evaluation approach should be allowed. Secondly, I agree with the point made by Carla and Wong Hei that first of all, when we apply in the predecessor approach or method, what kind of basic concept or principle we should have should be very clear. Then we come to details. So from my point of view, such as whether the comparative information should be restated. In current Chinese accounting standards, we require the companies to restate their comparative and information, because we believe that the combining entities, as if that entity has always been combined, existed. So the carrying amount, the information should continue, you know, to show that it has been under the same group. So it is not a shock, because if the comparative information not, you know, restated, so after the business combination happened, then this year there will be an increase of assets and liability. It looks like there's a big shock to the financial position and as well as financial performance. And secondly, whether the carrying amount used in applying the predecessor method should or should not be those reported by transferred entity. Generally, I agree with that, but there is a special situation. If that transferred entity was acquired several years ago by other group members, that acquisition is the business combination, not on the common control. So in this case, at that time, the group used acquisition method. So at the group account, they use fair value to account for the assets and the liability of the transferred, you know, entity. But if push down accounting not used, so the transferred entity still keep its original carrying amount. So in this case, later on, that transferred entity, that acquired entity, transferred to another subsidiary under group. So in this case, this is the business combination under control. So which carrying amount we should use? I believe that in this case, the carrying amount reported by the transferred entity should not be used. Mm. We should use those carrying amount reported at the group account. Mm. That is the fair value, actually, when they purchase the entity. So this is consistent with the underlying concept of the business combination and the common control. So I hope that first of all, we should, you know, clarify the basic concept or principle we should apply under this, you know, predecessor method, and then go to details, application issues. Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you to go back to Wong's analysis. I think it's hard to disagree that the criteria that we should use are the relevance and some others. But the relevance to whom? When you have two groups of investors, take a scenario 1B. You have the existing shareholders of P1, the parent, and assume P1 is listed. And you have the other group of shareholders, the NCI, the 30% in the public. And clearly, Alberto will say, oh, the guy is the 30% NCI has a need for information on the actual economic impact of the transaction, because from their perspective, it's not a business combination under common control from their perspective. But the shareholders in P1 would say, it's a business combination inside the group. We have not lost control of A, we have not lost control of B. Then we have accounting as NCI transactions, but there is no profit or gain, whatever. So which group of investors' needs should we prioritize in that case? Or would the answer be to say, there are two groups with different needs, so let's provide two sets of information on a different basis to the two groups?
Yeah, so what I'm saying is that there wouldn't be any one single preference. But so we are just coming down to NCI level, so like subdivision of users. Then if we go further down, then we may, extremely speaking, we may go down to one individual level of users. And if we ask many individual users, then they would come up with many different answers. So how far we are going to come down to the subsections or subgroups of users, then I guess only the question so far is to divide the group into two levels, NCIs and the controlling groups. So then we may need to contact more NCIs to find out what is the general view of the NCIs. There must be many different views among NCIs as well. So.
Kim?
Thanks. One of the issues that concerns me is that if we were to take up the common control aspect, well, then we would say A has made an acquisition, and how should they account for it? So if there really is an acquisition, in terms of IFRS 3 otherwise, then A would be accounting for that acquisition, you know, in the normal sense of it. But now we're saying, well, because it's under common control, are we concerned that, well, maybe it isn't really an acquisition? Or maybe because it's not at arm's length, there are some, you know, concerns there. And I suppose it just goes back to the point that Alexandra made around, you know, if the price is actually at arm's length, but you now need to account using book values, you know, you now end up by showing this sort of, you know, funny answer. So in his example, you pay 100, the book value is 75, and it now looks like you actually overpaid for something, but you didn't actually overpay for anything. You, in his example, you actually paid the fair value. So are we wanting to look at predecessor accounting to avoid, or as an anti-abuse mechanism, where if things aren't at arm's length, if they aren't at fair value, we don't want sort of just revaluations and accounting for things? So, you know, and that is sometimes the case in group restructurings, that maybe there isn't real substance to an acquisition, you're just simply moving things around, or in some cases where you might be creating a new entity and wanting to move things and all of a sudden result in a revaluation, so almost like a once-off revaluation. And I think that for those transactions, you know, I would, you know, say, well, yes, it doesn't make sense to allow fair value, because that would be tantamount just to a once-off revaluation. But in these other transactions where there really is an acquisition, you're not just taking an entity and saying I'm moving it into an empty company and saying I've now had an acquisition and I now want to have a revaluation. But if there is an acquisition, I'm almost thinking that the starting point should be, and it also goes back to the reporting entity, which I think a couple of people have raised, and looking at the conceptual framework as well, is that if the reporting entity here is A and B, so it doesn't include P1, from A's perspective, there's been a transaction and they've bought another entity. Yes, it happened to have been under common control, but they've bought something. So at that level, isn't there a transaction that should be reflected? So in Alexandro's case, if they paid 100 and the carrying value was 75, but the fair value is 100, IFRS 3 would have resulted in bringing in the fair values, etc. Maybe there still is a bit of goodwill, and that would be the answer. Taking his example slightly differently, if the fair value is 100, book value 75, but let's say that they only paid 75 for it. Well, then, if you did apply acquisition method, it would then say, well, actually, we got a bargain here. It's worth 100, but we only paid 75. Should there be a gain? Now, there I could see perhaps the question of saying, but in this situation, was it really just, you know, good negotiation on the part of A, or was it because of something else? And maybe that difference doesn't go to income in A's financial statements. Maybe it needs to go somewhere else. Similarly, if for some bizarre reason they paid 120 and it really is only worth 100, then again there could be some questions as to, well, you know, what's going on, and maybe that difference, you know, above 100 shouldn't go to goodwill. Maybe it's some form of distribution. So there's some other motivation there. But I do think that we need to understand what is the desire to use predecessor accounting. Is it to try and, as they prevent revaluations and things which we're saying, well, don't really, you know, shouldn't happen? But if there really is a combination of two entities and the reporting entity is the A and B group, I must say, you know, a possible argument is to say, you almost want to say you must apply acquisition accounting unless there's clear evidence that, well, there was no real combination. And in which case, you know, you can't just have revaluations and things like that. But, you know, if you do apply acquisition accounting, then I think then one needs to look at, should there be a day one gain? You know, should there be negative goodwill? Or maybe it's really it's a contribution from a shareholder, so it just goes to equity. But in Alexandro's situation, you know, to actually have the debit against equity. We've had situations in South Africa where people say, but, you know, how does this make any sense, where I've actually paid fair value for it and now the financial statements don't reflect that? So, yeah, I do think we need to be careful, because, again, if you were to ask a lot of preparers which method they like, depending on the circumstances, they like predecessor accounting. Why? Because they don't have to incur the costs of working out the fair values and all the things. And yes, if you are then saying, well, because at a P1 consolidated level, we have to undo everything, why go to the expense at the A level and all of that? But is that really a conceptual answer? So I can see practically a lot of people wanting predecessor just because they don't have to go to the effort of doing so. But does it really reflect the information? So I am concerned perhaps a little bit about the conceptual basis. I could see some practical advantages, but conceptually I'm perhaps a bit concerned that it doesn't really make sense in cases where there really is a proper combination.
That's something you mentioned, that may be a bizarre reason why you pay less in the book value. Actually, there is a very, very simple reason why you do that, is because tax credits are not present valued. So several times you end up paying less in book value effect because the tax credits that you are acquiring cannot be present valued. But on the valuation, you present value them. So your bizarre reason is actually quite common. Yeah.
Peter? I just wanted to comment on two aspects of the question of which user group, particularly where there's NCI present. And remembering we're focusing really on the sort of A and B subgroup here, not the P1 top group. The first thing is we put in the conceptual framework ED a statement that we thought that the NCI are more interested in, what they're really interested in is their subgroup. So they're interested in the AB subgroup here. Now, of course, they are also capital providers to the entire group as well, but that's not a good place to look for most of the information they look for. It's submerged in the whole group. So the NCI clearly are important users of the AB subgroup. And that's why we put that statement in there, I think, to try and clarify that that's the main place they ought to be looking for their information. The other point I wanted to make is that we say already in the conceptual framework that we're focusing particularly on users who aren't in a position to demand information, and so they have to rely on financial statements for their information. And of course, the controlling group usually are in a position to demand the information. So again, I think that suggests at the AB level, we probably ought to be focusing quite carefully on what the needs of the NCI is.
Okay. Julia, did you want to say
something? Maybe just, yes, just maybe like summarize my main takeaways from this discussion. And I think actually what Kim just discussed summarizes the discussion quite well. I think it comes down to the question, so is the transaction that we are looking at, so is a transaction actually demonstrating characteristics of an acquisition, is it demonstrating characteristics of a business combination that would have happened not under common control? And the fact that it happened at fair value could be one such indicator. And we're saying, okay, if we can define that population, then for that population, the acquisition method would provide most useful information for our targeted user groups. However, if there are business combinations under common control and group restructurings which do not demonstrate characteristics of an acquisition that are directed by controlling party, have nothing to do with fair values, then arguably the acquisition method would not provide useful information. And in fact, if we were to allow it, to require for all business combinations under common control, then controlling party could just artificially transfer values within a group. So I think it comes down to the question whether we can find a way to distinguish those populations.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.